The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Johnson, Judge Werke, Judge John P. Smith, the Honorable Matthew E. Johnson presiding.
Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. I apologize that we are just a little bit tardy. We had some technical difficulties, which we have now resolved. This panel of the court today will consider five cases, three of which will be submitted with oral argument, and two of which will be submitted without oral argument solely on the briefs. I will now call the first case on today's calendar. That is case number A24-1110, State of Minnesota versus Ashir Hassan Kimbrough. I believe counsel are familiar with our usual procedures, which are mostly the same in this online video format. Each of you will have 15 minutes for your principal arguments. We do have a time clock that's on the screen. If you have gallery view or some other view like that, you should be able to see the time clock. Please mute yourself when you are not presenting argument, but please keep your camera on so that we can see that you are present. Counsel for appellant, you may begin by introducing yourself and your clients, and then you may present your argument.
Thank you, and good morning to the court. Counsel, may it please the court. My name is Eva Wales, and I do represent the appellant, Ashir Kimbrough, in this matter. Mr. Kimbrough entered a Norgard guilty plea to first-degree criminal sexual conduct, and as part of the plea agreement, he waived a Blakely trial and admitted aggravating Blakely factors also on a Norgard basis. And Mr. Kimbrough raised two issues on appeal, but I would like to focus on the first one today, which is whether he should be allowed permitted to withdraw his Norgard plea to correct a manifest injustice. As part of the plea, not only did he waive his right to a Blakely trial, but he admitted the aggravating factors on the Norgard basis. In other words, he admitted facts to enhance the sentence, but was also promised a reduced 60-month sentence, requested that downward durational departure as well. This implicated both the accuracy and the intelligence of his plea, as the factors he conceded contrasted with the sentence he expected, and that shows that he did not understand the consequences of his plea. The Norgard admission to the Blakely factors was not accurate in that it's the role of the judge and not the defendant to make legal determination of what is a Blakely factor.
As I understand it, that as we all understand it, a Norgard plea has to have a strong factual basis, and then there also has to be an acknowledgement by your client that in fact, if he was convicted, that if this had went to a jury, that there would have been sufficient information. Are you disputing that he did not acknowledge that there was sufficient information? And what I'm getting at is your primary argument that there was not a strong factual basis?
No, that's not my primary argument. I agree that the prosecutor described at length the evidence that she anticipated coming into trial. My concern with that factual basis is that it was a recitation. Mr. Kimbrough never participated in any manner. Understandably, the Norgard plea, he can't participate as he would in a regular guilty plea, and that he doesn't remember the facts. But I'm not arguing.
The point of a Norgard plea is that he claims he asserted that he can't recall. So that's the whole reason you have a presentation of evidence or what it would be, including video or documentary evidence. So I'm not quite understanding your argument in terms of how the Norgard plea doesn't fit the parameters.
Yes, I understand the question, and I concede that the recitation of evidence by the prosecutor described a sufficient factual basis, and Mr. Kimbrough acknowledged that as he was required within the Norgard requirements that that a jury would be substantially likely to convict him. I would like to, I think, focus on the Blakely part of the plea. I do believe this implicates the entire plea. There's some concerns, and I think my brief, I would stand on my brief as far as the concerns underlying the Norgard aspect of the offense. Regarding, though, the Blakely waiver of the Blakely trial. I believe that was inaccurate, as well as the what was called the Norgaard admission to Blakely factors. I think there are a couple problems with that. One is that the admission to factors does not really make sense typically. And if a jury gets a Blakely question, the jury is the one, the fact finder is the one who determines the facts. And then the judge applies those facts to determine.
All right, let me then clarify this. I just want to make sure I understand your position. So are you arguing then the Blakely issue because it was the waiver was that a jury wouldn't consider it and that it went to the judge?
So Mr. Kimbrough was, as part of the plea agreement, agreed to waive the Blakely jury and agreed to admit Blakely factors, quote unquote factors, on the Norgaard basis. So his waiver of the Blakely trial, I believe, was insufficient. It was not accurate. It was not complete. It didn't fit the requirements of Rule 1501, Subdivision 2, which is obviously a different subdivision than Subdivision 1. And he had that he has to go through the court, the counsel needs to go through an entire waiver of a jury trial for that Blakely basis with the defendant. That didn't happen sufficiently here. The judge's words were confusing. There were waivers of a few things, but not every requirement. And then additionally, as a second problem, the admission to the Blakely factors was really it was just kind of glossed over. Counsel and the court repeated, "You admit." I'm not having a direct quote here, but paraphrasing, "You admit Blakely factors of particular cruelty in a zone of privacy," and essentially he said yes on the Norgaard basis. So there was never, for example, if it goes to a jury, there's generally a special interrogatory that says, were these facts found that whatever the fact was, that he hit the victim, that it occurred in a bedroom, something like that. And then the judge applies those facts to determine, is the aggravating Blakely factor met here? The defendant, especially on a Norgaard basis, cannot admit that legal, somehow make that legal finding by a Norgaard admission that there is an aggravating factor. So that wasn't sufficient. Those two kind of go part and parcel. And I think also then implicate the underlying plea because it indicates that he didn't understand the consequences. When he admits, and let's just take those aggravating factors, let's assume that he admits aggravating factors appropriately, that this offense is more serious than a typical such offense. And then as part of the plea agreement and his sentencing argument, he's going to ask for a downward durational departure, also downward dispositional, but focusing on the durational aspect. He cannot both admit that it's more serious than typical and then consistently ask or argue that it's less serious than typical. So that was part of the agreement that indicates he doesn't understand the aspect of the sentencing aspect, which is a direct consequence of his plea. That part is legally impossible. His attorney actually at the sentencing hearing, although said, yes, he admits aggravating factors, here's our argument why it's less serious than typical. Those two legal concepts just don't square. So that indicates that he doesn't understand the consequences of the plea as well as preceding that problem, the problem with the admission of factors rather than what are facts. He never separately, as part of the Blakely portion of this plea, he never separately, or nobody went through with him, what facts do you admit? What facts are we, you know, hoping to tie to the aggravating factors here? So I think on kind of on those two levels, the Blakely aspect of the plea agreement was carried out improperly and unconstitutionally, frankly. We also believe that because that Blakely admission was tied part and parcel of the plea agreement
Ms.
and
Wales, before you go on, let me go back to, I guess, can you explain further why exactly it's improper for him to admit the existence of the aggravating factors? I mean, I think, yeah. Can you just explain that further, the underlying concepts, and is there any case law that supports your specific argument on that point?
Yes, my point on that comes from State v. Rourke, which is a 2009 State Supreme Court case, which explains that in a Blakely trial, the jury is the one that decides whether the state proved a fact, and the district court later applies that fact to decide whether it supports an aggravating factor. So I guess I'm trying to make the distinction between the finder of the fact. In this case, if a person pleads guilty, let's call them the fact finder in that case. So whether it's the jury, whether it's a defendant waiving the jury and admitting a Blakely a fact, which the judge would then apply and say, does this meet the aggravating factor? Maybe there's an argument as to whether it's a zone of privacy. Maybe there's an argument as to whether a child was present or witnessing or downstairs in a house, something like
So,
that.
okay, so in Rourke was in the case of a trial, a contested trial,
Right.
but if there's a plea and a plea agreement, I mean, is there any case law or legal principle that limits the things to which the defendant can agree, so as to not allow the defendant to have a binding agreement about the existence of aggravating factors? It seems like, plea agreements come in a lot of varieties based on the bargaining of the parties, but it seems like there's other types of terms to a plea agreement that might be not just pure facts or factual matters, but they might be legal conclusions. I mean, sometimes the defendant might agree, the state might agree that the defendant is particularly amenable to probation. Now that's the flip side of state's agreement, but I guess I'm just wondering why this term. I think what you're saying is this is the type of plea agreement term to which a defendant cannot give valid consent, or that can't be part of a plea agreement in any case, I think. I don't understand the legal underpinnings of that.
Sure. Yeah. And I think it's a I do think it's confusing. And that's part of the issue here, especially given the context that it's a Nordgaard plea. And so I think that more care does need to be taken for what is the defendant admitting, I guess, within the Nordgaard plea. So that is a background. Other than that, I believe that I think when a defendant is asked to make, let's call it a legal conclusion or kind of make a quasi-legal conclusion, generally the judge needs to affirm that. So in your example of particular amenability to probation, if a judge does not say, yes, I make that finding that the defendant is particularly amenable to probation, I can anticipate the state, for example, arguing on appeal, the judge never made that finding, that it may just be, a sentence, not a lengthy finding or explanation that the court needs to engage in, but to say the defendant is prepared to admit these facts, we would ask the court to make a determination of aggravating factors or particularly amenable. But the court is the one that needs to do that, to make that ultimate legal conclusion. The parties can agree that it's there. The court then needs to verify, yes, I agree that's there, or not, if it's not sufficient. So I can't, I was not able to find a case on point, especially regarding the Norgard aspect here. But regarding, I think, your question of the legal conclusions within a plea agreement, I believe that the court essentially needs to verify that and make that legal finding. Maybe based on the party's agreement, that's helpful to the court, but maybe there is an agreement and the court then needs to decide that. I think typically in the case of the Blakely factors and trial, the defendant often waives a Blakely jury. and leaves it to the court. And the court may say, you admitted this fact, you admitted this fact. I find that these facts meet the aggravating factors. So I guess I would say that there does need to be that judicial determination.
And to clarify, I guess, am I correct in understanding that your argument, I think, is as a matter of law? I mean, you're asking us to, I think, reason through this by saying that this is something a defendant never can agree to in any case. Or is your argument more case specific that there's some flaw simply in this case?
I believe that that a defendant cannot agree to that there are aggravating factors. The defendant can agree that there are facts and then submit that to the court to determine if that aggravating factor has been found. I think it is more problematic in this case because it's that we have the Norgaard component and it's not clear what Mr. Kimbrough understands or admits. There was the long factual basis recitation by the prosecutor regarding the underlying offense. And then they got to the Blakely portion and there was never a separate connection, I guess, or a separate outline of here are the facts that we would use to support the aggravating factor. So that's an additional problem in this case. I only have 20 seconds left. I will cede the rest of my time and come back on rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Wales. Counsel for respondent, you may begin by introducing yourself and your client, and then you may present your argument.
Oh, thank you. I'm Shane Baker. I'm Gandria County attorney for the state of Minnesota in this case. Please, the court and counsel. As with the appellant, there are a number of legal issues and lengthy briefs, so a lot I'll rely on that, hopefully tailoring it to some of the arguments here. Just some general themes that I saw through the arguments put by the appellant, that one, it seeks to add requirements that haven't been previously stated. So for example, for a factual basis, requiring linking facts to specific elements as a mandate, or that the court explain how the facts meet the elements, such as I think the example given by appellant was how the firing of the gun related to the force element of the charge. And these are things that aren't required in the factual basis, certainly not in a factual basis for Norgaard, which has the two elements of that there's a strong factual basis and that the defendant acknowledges it. Now, the strong factual basis is ensured by the court in its careful review. It had here 5 pages of transcript testimony, so it wasn't just conclusory facts or statements such as defendant assaulted victim. It was had a lot of detail in it. It gave the sources of the evidence, photo, recording, testimony, law enforcement observations. And I gave an example where there is a lot of layers of corroboration, such as on the appellant's presence at the scene, recording, observation, so forth. So when the court does that, it gets a strong factual basis, and that's what's required. It's not required that the defendant himself articulate, and especially in Norgaard, because he's saying, I don't remember what happened. As it relates to Blakely, it is true that it was all wrapped up in one factual basis presentation, but specific details were articulated, including that the offense was in the employee-only bathroom, that there was pulled hair, fractures, appellant repeatedly saying he would not, or that the victim would not forget his face. I'm not sure if there should be a, if it's a, especially on a guilty plea, if there's a distinction that's worth any difference here, whether it's a factor or a fact. Because on a Norgaard, it's still the court that has to ensure there's sufficient information that supports that underlying plea. And as I stated in the brief, the court's not mandated, and this turns into the legal impossibility arguments is the district court's not legally required to issue an aggravated sentence. They can take the admissions or the facts before it of where the offense took place, the fractures, all that kind of information that would fit particular cruelty, and simply determine they are more persuaded by the defendant's arguments over remorse. And that's probably the best case where you can have downward durational departure mixing with the presence of facts supporting an aggravated sentence. That's why I use the literary example I did of Dr. Jekyll and Hyde. Is we, in a sense, the defendant's coming to the court saying, yes, these acts were very bad. They, not disputing they happen, but that's not me. It's due to the addiction. And there was calculated decisions on how that information would get to the court. And that seems to be what the challenge really is here, is the judge was not persuaded by appellant's district court arguments. So I'm just scanning through. Case law I found is, because there's talk about what rights were mentioned or how detailed the Blakely elements of the plea waiver were. Now, I acknowledge that not every single right listed in under Rule 15 was articulated specifically connected to Blakely, but at least the one case I found remotely touching on these issues, Brown, said strict adherence in this Blakely context not required. And we have a defendant who still completed a plea petition form with all the rights acknowledged. The district court judge went over quite a few of those rights specifically connected with Blakely, asked him if he understood his rights. He said yes. There's no questions raised about whether the rights not stated, did they apply to Blakely or not? In a sense, and I know a lot of this I'm articulating is kind of, it certainly would be a better practice to do certain things. But as Brown said, strict adherence is not what's mandated. So because the court did go through that with the underlying guilty plea, plus specifically with regards to the Blakely portion on a number of the rights, such as the reasonable doubt standard. I had a huge quote in the brief, I'll defer to that. So our position, it was sufficient. The waiver was sufficient. Question though came up, well, say the court doesn't believe that's so, and what should be done? I feel like that should be addressed. Is the cases the appellant cites don't refer to the situation where it's the underlying guilty plea and a Blakely. They're strictly the guilty plea, which has some charges dismissed, some agreements in sentencing, that situation. There, they're more intricately connected. Here, if my position is correct that the underlying guilty plea had no problems, the appellant's trying to get out of a constitutionally valid plea by challenging the portion that only negatively impacts him. He benefits just as much from having this court, if it were to say, the Blakely was insufficient, but we're going to let the guilty plea stand and then remand it back to the court to whether have another Blakely trial, have another admission, proceed in that regard. It seems like an appellant should be able to benefit from the constitutionally invalid part by applying it to the constitutionally valid part. Again, our position is that it was valid and strict adherence is not required, or at least it's harmless error, given no information to support confusion over what rights he had. The sentencing provisions, our position is the court was very thorough in its arguments, cited to the relevant law, addressed trog factors. It considered what the appellant was putting forward. It laid out the law clearly, lengthy or statement at sentencing, and a lengthy sentencing memorandum in support of that. Our position is that the court validly sentenced both denying the downward departure motions and in sentencing in light of aggravating factors. That's my argument. Thank you.
It appears there are no questions from the bench. Thank you, Mr. Baker. Ms. Wales, you have an opportunity for rebuttal argument.
Thank you. Just a couple points, and then of course I'd answer any questions panel may have. Respondent mentioned that the cases cited, I think by both of us, don't involve this type of situation in which there's a guilty plea and then a purported Norgaard admission to Blakely factors. And I think that kind of goes to the concern that this doesn't happen and this was an improper procedure. Norgaard admission of factors, as I discussed earlier, should not happen. Legally, the factors are different than the facts, and it's problematic that it happened in this case. The respondent mentioned that the court would not be required, as far as the sentence goes, the court would not be required to depart upward. However, if the I think we'd all be hard pressed to think of a situation in which a defendant admitted that his or her crime was more serious than the typical admitted two aggravating factors, and then the court did not depart upward. Be possible. I think it's extremely unlikely. And then here to both make the admission that it's more serious and then to argue that it's less serious, you can't have those two things. And that does implicate his understanding and the intelligence of the plea in that he didn't understand the consequences of the plea. I touched on a bit earlier and will also mention that this does implicate the entire plea. It was the second line within the plea petition written out that the defendant would admit the Blakely factors and waive the Blakely jury trial and admit those factors on a Norgaard basis. That was part of the plea agreement. There were two offenses that were two charges, excuse me, that were dismissed. And then the sentence itself was open. There was an agreement, but it was specifically stated in the petition the state would ask for the maximum possible double of the top range of the presumptive duration of 344 months, while the defendant would argue both for the dispositional and durational departure. I would agree that a dispositional departure downward and a durational departure upward would be legally possible. That's where I would say that's logically inconsistent. I think that's extremely unlikely. We don't see those situations hardly ever. I think, again, we'd all be hard pressed to find a situation like this, even if I did argue that trog factors, were present and that the judge erred, but I think it's extremely unlikely that in a first-degree crim sex case, somebody's going to get a dispositional departure anyway. So, especially admitting the offense is more serious than typical. So, I think those concerns and questions about did he understand the possible consequences and sentence implicate that underlying plea as well. If there are no further questions from this court, then we would ask that you allow Mr. Kimbrough to withdraw his guilty plea and remand for further proceedings to the district court. I would also note that if for some reason this court feels that the record is not sufficient, a remand for more findings or a hearing is possible, but we think that the record is sufficient without that he be allowed to withdraw his plea. Thank you.
It appears there are no further questions. Thank you, Ms. Wales. Thank you to both counsel for your arguments. The case is submitted. The court will issue its opinion in writing within 90 days.